This week on the show, an up and down week for Red Sox Nation. Sean McAdam breaks it down with us, plus game two of the NBA Finals, as well as some golf talk. We finally touch on Tiger. All that and more coming up. Calling It starts right now. Welcome into Calling It. Alex Barth, Alex Lebowitz from our studio in Wesley, Massachusetts. The summer moves on and we have continuous Red Sox coverage like we have since the season started. Today, helping us break down what is a mess of a pitching staff and everything else is Sean McAdam. He's covered the Red Sox for 32 years from the Providence Journal, the Boston Herald, 98.5 The Sports Hub, and many more. Sean, thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure, guys. Nice to be with you.
So we'll start with the big question, David Price. We've seen him now two starts since coming back from the injury. The first one, so-so, but pitched great the other night in Baltimore. Is there reason for Red Sox fans to be optimistic about their big money pitcher?
Well, certainly the second one was very encouraging. The first one was maybe as you might have expected for a guy that hadn't faced major league hitters since last October. A little bit of a first step feeling out, five innings and three runs allowed to the White Sox, but a much more dominant and complete effort on Price's part the other night in Baltimore. And as I said, the word is encouraging. I don't know that that's necessarily what's in store every 5 days when Price takes the ball. I think there's going to be a little holding of the breath by a lot of Red Sox fans regarding Price for much of the year, because obviously he's dealing with an issue in his forearm and elbow, and you wonder, is that a matter of waiting for the other shoe to drop? But if he can make the kind of strides he did from the first start to the second one and continue at that level, then that would be very good indeed for that Red Sox rotation.
So right as David Price comes back, it's funny, Eduardo Rodriguez, he gets hurt. He's on the 10-day DL. Should Red Sox fans be concerned over this re-injury?
I think it is a little bit of a red flag, because it has happened so often with Rodriguez over the last couple of years. In fact, this knee situation dates back to his time in the Orioles minor league system and was one of the reasons that he was available in that Andrew Miller trade that the Red Sox made in 2014, when they looked to deal off Miller at the deadline and were out of contention. They were a little surprised that the Orioles were willing to talk about Rodriguez, in part because some in the organization in Baltimore were concerned that this knee thing he had taken too long to recover from, and, you know, what did this say about him, and was this something that they were going to have to worry about? And it's since subsequently reared its head three separate times since joining the Red Sox. It happened a year ago spring training. It happened again in this offseason as he was pitching in winter ball. And then it happened last week in Baltimore when he slipped on the mound. So, early reports suggest that this is not nearly as severe a case as the one he encountered in spring training of 2016, which cost him nearly the first 2 months of the year. But, you wonder, is this something that you're going to have to be half-braced for to happen every season, because it is a recurring condition with him, and it makes you wonder about his durability.
So if he is out for a couple weeks, it's not as severe, but if he's out for a couple weeks, you also have the Brian Johnson injury. Where will the Red Sox go to fill that void in the starting rotation?
Yeah, I mean, Johnson's hamstring issue, which I think they're going to find out a little bit more about today. They could possibly wait as long as Saturday, I think, because of today's off day, before that turn comes up in the rotation. So that buys them a little time, and maybe it's enough for Johnson to recover from having to come out of a game with a hamstring tightness the other night in Pawtucket. Johnson had pitched extremely well, of course, in his most recent start at the big league level with a complete game shutout of Tampa Bay. This certainly calls into question his availability, at least in the immediate future. And if they have to go somewhere else, the chances, the choices are not nearly as appetizing. You've got Henry Owens, who is working through some delivery issues, but is still having difficulty with his command. You've got Kyle Hendrick, who was not effective in a spot start for Boston earlier in the year. And you've also got Velasquez, who they signed from Mexico in the offseason and added for some depth, and he too was not very effective in one start that they gave him. So I'm sure they're crossing their fingers about Johnson being able to recover quickly from this hamstring issue, because the alternatives are not nearly as encouraging.
It seems like this last week gave me whiplash following the Red Sox starting pitching storylines. Went from them having a three-man rotation on Tuesday to suddenly people were confident saying they should have a six-man rotation. As it stands right now, assuming everybody's healthy, what is the ideal Red Sox five-man rotation? Obviously, you're going to have Sale and Porcello at the top, but after that, what are they trying to put together in those back three spots?
Well, obviously, Price would fit into that top three, however you wanted to configure those guys. When each is at its best, you know, you're talking about three elite starters. Price is a former Cy Young Award winner who finished second as recently as a couple of years ago. Porcello is the reigning Cy Young winner in the American League. And Sale's a guy who probably is the front runner for the award this year. So that's a pretty good front three. And then when healthy, you've got the other two lefties at the back end, Pomerantz and Rodriguez, although Rodriguez is obviously not available at least for the next start or two.
From the pitching rotation of the offense, the top of the lineup, which gave the Red Sox so much help during their big win streak a couple weeks ago, has gone cold. Benintendi just breaking out of his slump yesterday with the two home runs against Baltimore. What about the Red Sox top of the lineup has been so hot and cold for them this year, where they seem to be very streaky? And does having Dustin Pedroia in the lineup affect the way those guys around him hit?
I'm sure there's some effect. You know, Pedroia has served either as the leadoff hitter or the number two hitter for the last couple of years, and his presence is missed. They've been experimenting for a while now with Mookie in that leadoff spot, which, you know, I get the sense that he's the kind of hitter that it almost doesn't matter. This is a guy that last year hit both leadoff and cleanup at times, and if you're versatile enough to do both those things, that marks you as a pretty special offensive player with the speed and stolen base ability and ability to score runs and create offense at the top. But he's also enough of a run producer and slugger that he can hit fourth and drive in runs. So I'm a believer that sometimes people pay way too much attention to batting order in terms of what it means for production and output. I think that you can mix and match a lot when you have good players for the most part, although some of them may be creatures of habit. It seems to me, my experience is the best guys are going to produce and hit no matter where they are. The fact that Pedroia remains out probably until Friday means they've had to make some adjustments in that top third with him not being a part of it. Whether he goes back to the leadoff spot when he returns or whether they keep Betts there remains to be seen, but you know, they do have a lot of weapons they can interchange at the top, in the top three or four spots.
With Mookie in the leadoff spot, it seems to continue a new trend in the MLB with hitters maybe a little more inclined toward power than we've seen in the past at the top of the order. Charlie Blackmon in Colorado. We saw Kyle Schwarber earlier in the year in Chicago. What are your thoughts on, and you kind of just said order's not a big deal to you, but what are your thoughts on this trend? And do you like this trend of a little more pop in the top spot in the lineup?
Yeah, I mean, we're getting away from that prototypical idea of a leadoff hitter being a guy who can get a bunt down, who can steal a base, who maybe doesn't have a lot of power, is more of a singles and doubles guy. But, you know, I mean, that's sort of a somewhat outdated view of the leadoff spot. Now teams are looking at on-base ability as much as anything, and so you don't necessarily have to have a high batting average as long as you can work some walks and be selective to add to your on-base percentage. But it's also seen now as a bonus. If you can put a guy there with some power, yeah, he may be coming up to bat a lot in situations where there isn't anybody on base. Obviously, he's doing that to lead off the game. And he may be doing it because guys in the eighth and ninth spot, when the order flips over, are not on base as much. But that seems less important to a lot of managers. They want to get as many at-bats and plate appearances for their most productive hitters. And you can define productive in a lot of ways. It could be a guy that maybe doesn't have great speed, although Betts has that. And, you know, you mentioned Schwarber as a guy hitting leadoff, and I know he's struggling a lot with the Cubs, but he's nobody's idea of the, you know, classic leadoff hitter. He's a big, you know, he kind of looks like a softball player. He doesn't have great speed. He's maybe not the most athletic guy, but he gets on base and he has the ability to drive the ball out of the ballpark and hit the ball for extra bases. And Betts is almost, you know, a hybrid. He has the ability to steal a base. He can, you know, take the extra base, go first to third on a single. He can score from second on a single. He can score from first on a double. And ultimately, it's all about getting on base and scoring runs, and certainly Betts is capable of both of those things.
So when we're talking to Sean McAdams, Sean, up until a couple weeks ago, the Red Sox, they've kind of been underperforming. You mentioned it. They have three guys at the top of their rotation right now who are at one point were Cy Young candidates or winners, and this lineup is stacked, in my opinion, but they were underperforming. Where, if anywhere, do you place the blame for that?
Well, I know that there was a lot of speculation about Farrell's job security a few weeks ago, and even some national media reports suggesting that he was really being turned up and he could conceivably get fired if they didn't have a good week. I never sensed that that was the case. I think that there's sort of a reflexive action around here now that anytime a team loses three in a row, it's got to be the manager's fault. It's time to make a change. I think, you know, you could make the case that this team has not been fully healthy all year long. They've never had, their entire rotation and their projected starting lineup ready to go at the same time, and they still don't. With Pedroia out and Rodriguez out now and Wright gone for the year, they've dealt with that, and to be fair, certainly there are a number of other teams that have been hit by injuries, and the Red Sox are hardly alone in that regard. I think there are some holes on the roster. I think maybe there should have been a little bit more attention paid to finding a right-handed bat to play third base in conjunction with Sandoval. The expectation was he would be healthy, in better shape, and be available to go. But you only have to look at the numbers from the right side the last two or three years to realize that he really struggled when he hits right-handed. They traded Shaw away to get Thornburg. Thornburg goes down with a shoulder injury and still hasn't been heard from. So that has not worked out in the short term. But it seemed like there wasn't a backup plan. And, you know, frankly, that has to be laid at Dave Dombrowski's feet in constructing the roster. Some of the injuries, and even injuries with players who have played through them, like Hanley Ramirez and some shoulder issues, which undoubtedly has impacted and reduced his effectiveness, that obviously isn't anyone's fault. It's just a fact of life and something that they have to deal with. But, to the degree that maybe they haven't overcome some of them, then, you know, to me, that goes to roster construction and, by extension, the general manager, or in this case, the president of baseball operations.
Sean, one more question before we let you go. You mentioned the production at third base with Pablo Sandoval. We're about a month and a half till the trade deadline, but do you see Dombrowski making any moves to get someone at third base?
Well, I think a lot of it is going to be prioritizing need as we get a little closer to the deadline. It may well be that, you know, as Sandoval comes back from this knee injury and finds himself a little bit, that things stabilize over there and whether you end up with a platoon of Marrero and Sandoval or work Rutledge into the conversation a little bit more, or later in the year take a look at Rafael Devers, the 20-year-old prospect at AA. It may be that when we get to the end of July, and that's, you know, it's less than 2 months away, but a lot can happen then. A lot can happen in a week, as we saw in the last week with some of the injuries that came out of nowhere. Typically, you know, pitching is what general managers are looking for at the deadline. It may be to bolster the bullpen. It may be to create some additional depth in the rotation to make up for the injuries to Wright and maybe guard against future injuries to both Price and Rodriguez. And usually that takes priority. It isn't necessary to have a guy who's an all-star caliber player at every position. I think fans kind of get lulled into, you know, well, so-and-so's only hitting 260 with 10 homers and 50 RBIs. They got to upgrade. Well, you can upgrade at a lot of positions, but at the end of the day, you have to make some choices and prioritize things. And I think before we're able to determine whether third base is something that they try to fix at the deadline, I think we have to know where else they are health-wise in another 6 weeks, and that's hard to forecast. Certainly, third base is near the top of the list now, but it may well be that other needs that are more critical overtake that by the time we get to the end of July.
Again, we're talking with Sean McAdams. Sean, I know you got to scoot. One more quick question for you. It may escape the casual baseball fan, but the MLB draft is tonight. Red Sox picking towards the bottom of the first round, of course, with their finish last year, but still a lot of good talent on the board this year. Where do you see the Red Sox going in the first round of the draft?
You know, I haven't studied the class of available amateurs as much as I have in the past, so I couldn't give you a name that they seem to be looking for, but I will tell you that I get the sense that the Red Sox have shown, and they did last year in selecting Jason Groom, who had some questions attached to him and had kind of number one overall talent, but because of some questions about his agents and his eligibility and some off-field issues, he ended up dropping to the Red Sox a little bit later, and they took a little bit of a chance. I think that you know, it's not a draft where you're necessarily drafting for immediate need. This isn't the NFL where a guy can step in at wide receiver the next year as a rookie and have an impact. Even as quickly as players are getting to the big leagues, it's still usually a couple of years before they're making an impact. A guy like Benintendi is a bit of an exception. So I think they probably go for best overall player. That seems rather obvious. But I think they've also shown a willingness to reach a little bit and maybe take a chance with a guy who might have some signability issues or maybe some questions or some injury questions, but has a higher ceiling than somebody else. It's such a crapshoot, the baseball draft, because you're trying to project sometimes where 17- and 18-year-old kids are going to be 5 years down the road. And I think Dombrowski's, and I applaud him for this, I think he's sort of thinking a little bit more outside the box and is willing to take a big swing at somebody like he did with Groom last year rather than take the safe conventional choice when it's their turn.
And of course, there's always a good chance Dombrowski just trades him in about a year for a reliever with a bum elbow. Sean McAdams, thanks so much for coming on, taking the time, filling us in on the Red Sox. There's a lot of questions to be answered around this team right now, and you answered them very well. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
Colin, it is a Snap Call Sports production. Snap Call Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snap Call, the game within the game.
All right, welcome back to Callin' It. Thanks to Sean McAdams for talking Red Sox with us. Alex Barth, Alex Lebowitz, and I deserve some licking. I got to take it. I had a very strong take on David Price last week. He pitched okay in his first start on Monday. He pitched great Saturday night. I was wrong.
Yeah, you were. You were wrong big time. They should just ride him out of town, try to get him out so that he just voids his contract.
I'll stand by that. I still don't want to pay him. And I'm still – look, he had a couple good starts. Let's wait and see.
It's baseball. Who cares how much you're paying him? And it's John Henry's money. I want him to spend as much as possible.
Spend it here instead of the soccer club. Look, yeah. Price had a fantastic – he was great. Was it Saturday night?
Yeah.
He was outstanding. That was old school Tampa Bay David Price.
He was throwing hard, too. Harder than
he was
last year.
He was throwing hard. But you know what? And I said this. This was part of my anti-Price take last week. I said I don't think he can necessarily adjust and be that guy that's going to become more of a finesse pitcher. And he has to throw his fastball by people to be successful. No, he adjusted. He was very cheeky in his start on Saturday night. He had a lot of strikeouts. I'm intrigued. My interest has been piqued. I'm sure he cares so much. He probably does because it's David Price. But my interest has been piqued. I'm looking forward to his next start.
There's really not a lot of pressure on him anymore. You know, you got Chris Sale, you got Rick Porcello, even Drew Pomeranz is pitching well.
But there shouldn't be pressure, but it seems like he always creates pressure. He always finds
He's a head case.
He is. Yeah. That doesn't change. But you know, look, he was good. Chris Sale was good the other night. I like this team's rotation. Unfortunately, I had a rough week for takes. Brian Johnson got hurt, so we might not see him again for a bit. I know Sean said he might pitch Saturday. I don't know if you saw the video of his injury.
Brian Johnson?
Yeah. From Pawtucket. Yeah. That looked like more than a week. That was a little – he went down.
And he can't catch a break, it seems like.
I feel so bad for the guy.
It's awful. You root for him. He's a guy you really root for, but – he's gone through a lot in the past year and a half, and finally seems to be breaking through. And right after that complete game shutout, hamstring injury.
So can I shift my David Price hate here? Can I pivot this?
Yeah, let's see what you got.
I'm done with Sandoval. Enough chances.
Oh, yeah.
Dude's terrible. And I know this is an easier take, and it's easy for me to fall back on that. But I said in this show at the beginning of the year, we had Matt McCarthy on doing preseason preview. Pablo Sandoval wouldn't be the starting third baseman June 1st. Now he was, but as like the fourth, fifth string guy, I had no idea what kind of mess we were going to see at third base, but there's got to be something better. I know they don't want to move Sam Travis over there, fine, because he's been hitting well in his role, and I think you keep him in that role. But there's got, I mean, Marrero's played great. I'll take more Marrero. And you know what? If you have to platoon Sandoval, maybe platoon Rutledge.
Yeah.
I'm done. I'm done with Sandoval.
Yeah.
And now, of course, because I'm saying this, he's going to hit, you know, 380 this week, couple home runs, drive in 10, which great. They're playing the Yankees. I'm all for it. But I'm done with this guy.
I mean, there's still got to be something there. You know, he was an all-star. He was a World Series MVP.
How many times have we said? Do you realize in his, what is it now, fourth year with the Red Sox? What is he, in his third or fourth year?
Third year.
Third year, how many games he's played at the major league level? About 150.
Yeah.
How many chances are we going to give this guy? And okay, just to clear that up, yes, less game, but less games does mean more chances. He hasn't played it, and I mean, some of it's been due to injury, but some of it has just been due to the fact that he sucks.
And I mean, him being out of shape, then having to lose a bunch of weight, that has to have some type of effect on your body. Like, you're not going to be as durable. There's not, maybe I'm not a doctor, but I feel like they're all correlated. I don't know.
I think just being that big and having to carry that much weight all the time would be an issue, because it's mostly been lower body stuff. I know one of them was a shoulder, but mm-hmm. I think a lot of it's been lower body stuff.
Yeah. No, it has been. I don't know. I just think right now they don't have any options. If there was, a Travis Shaw here, someone who could produce at the hot corner, he'd probably still be in Pawtucket.
They blew that one, didn't they?
Oh, my God. And it doesn't seem like Thornburg's coming back anytime soon.
I'm still not under the belief that we're going to see Carson Smith. It's like the Tooth Fairy. I'll believe when I see it. I keep hearing this mythical being, Carson Smith, who's going to come from nowhere and save the bullpen. But what are we've been waiting 2 years on this guy. We haven't seen anything.
It's really unfortunate because he was dynamite in Seattle.
He was so good.
Really
even
good.
Limited time we saw him for the Red Sox. Yeah. I think he's pitched a couple innings. He looked good.
Yeah, and I don't know. It's the Dombrowski curse. He trades for a reliever, and they get hurt as soon as they put on a Red Sox uniform. It's like, I don't know. It's not like a curse.
They get hurt putting on the uniform. They can't even get it on.
Yeah, it's absolutely ridiculous. And you trade valuable bats for it. I'm under the impression, and Sean McAdam said it in our interview, that the Red Sox are good enough to carry the weight.
Yeah.
You know, you Devin Marrero isn't my favorite. He's not a guy who's going to hit 300 for you. But if he plays well defensively and at least isn't that much of a detriment, put him there.
He's been a major league ball player.
Yeah, yeah, sure. I think, especially that 2-home run game he had last week, that was awesome to watch. You like to watch him play. He plays hard. You can't really say the same with Pablo
Sandoval.
It's
been probably once or twice a game with him that he'll make a nice play at third. There was one against Baltimore, I know, where it wasn't really a bunt. It was kind of a half swing, and he charges in bare hands, fluid motion to first to get Adam Jones, who's quick. And I'm sitting there, Sandoval couldn't have made that play. And I'm saying that probably 2 or 3 times a night.
Yeah.
No, I like Marrero. And you know what? I will say this. For all our complaining right now about the Red Sox, my complaining about the Red Sox, I won't throw you under the bus with me here.
Yeah.
I'm excited for this week. This is the first time in a long time we've gotten to be excited about a Red Sox-Yankees series. I know everybody was saying that the Red Sox-Orioles rivalry was this new budding thing, and I kind of took that on the show. It's not. It was a flash in the pan. This is real. These two teams are at the top of the division. This should be a hell of a summer, and it's going to kick off with this series.
And I think it's going to expose the Yankees and the Red Sox for what they are. In my opinion...
I love that take. Expose them for what they are. I love that take.
The Yankees have been overperforming. That's my honest opinion. Their pitching staff is not good. They benefited from having a guy, Aaron Judge, who's, I have to admit it, he's awesome to watch.
He's fantastic.
He's unbelievable, and he seems to be the next great Yankee in the making.
I mean, him and Mookie, the next 10, 15 years.
And, I mean, if you want to compare Red Sox, Mookie, Xander, and Benintendi, I think that's more exciting, personally. But I think that this is a team that's been overperforming, and to me, that credit goes to a guy like Joe Girardi. He seems to get the best out of every team. That's a different discussion. But the Red Sox have been underperforming, and that's really where I want to go. You look at these past couple weeks, the pitching rotation has really come to grips. They you have Pomerantz, who's going for his third straight quality start. This is a huge start for him, let alone the series for the Red Sox. And I think if he does pitch well, he's probably closer to that all-star caliber guy than what he showed us in the second half of last season.
And props on him for getting the start. So we won't see, me and you were just going over the starters for the series. Tanaka, Pomerantz, Game 1, Sabathia, Porcello, Game 2, Price and Pineda, Game 3. Thanks for looking that up. It would have been really easy to start the series to bump Drew Pomerantz out of the series to get Chris Sale in it. He'll start on Friday, so he'll start the game after. We won't see Sale this series, and that to me is just a testament to how confident they are in Pomerantz right now.
Yeah, and you have to be with the way he's been pitching. It's really since that Oakland start where he kind of had the back and forth with Farrell. He was pulled after 4 innings when he had like 120 pitches in that span.
I don't know what he was thinking, but it worked.
Yeah, it's ever since then he's responded. Is Pomerantz the toughest guy in my opinion? He hasn't shown it, but the last couple starts he's really played like an all-star caliber guy. Not saying that's what he really is. But if you get that type of production out of your fourth best starter, I'll take that. I'll take that any day.
Is this a make or break series for the Red Sox? This is a very crucial point in the season. After the roller coaster week we just had, and I think that the term to describe this team this year is bipolar. I've been using that all year, and it didn't fit any better Saturday night when David Price was incredible, and then Craig Kimbrel came in and just was a mess.
Yeah.
This team has been so up and down, so roller coaster, whiplash. You can use all those words. I'm starting to run out. Is this a make or break series for the Red Sox?
I think if they come into the series and if they sweep them, or even if they sweep them, win 2 out of 3.
If they sweep, start the duck boats.
This could be the turning point. I really think that. My only problem is you mentioned it. They're inconsistent. So they could sweep the Yankees this series, and then in another month they fall below 500.
Right.
I don't know. But, you know, they've been inconsistent. They have the talent, though. Their roster is stacked.
So
I've been
stacked.
Saying this all season long. Their bullpen, in my opinion, has been pretty good. The production you've gotten out of Joe Kelly, Craig Kimbrell.
Matt Barnes,
Heath Hembry. And with Carson Smith, I think he will come back in the next couple weeks, even though the Red Sox are bad at that stuff. But, yeah, I think this could be the turning point for the Red Sox.
I think, you know, if you sweep, you got to be talking about up and down aside, that's got to give you great confidence going into a summer that they'll spend most of on the road. The series is at Yankee Stadium, so some good road wins too. We're going to step aside real quick. We'll come back. NBA Finals, Game 2. We'll break it down. Some golf talk as well. We'll finally touch on Tiger. You're listening to Callin' It, brought to you by Snap Call Sports.
Callin' It is a Snap Call Sports production. Snap Call Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snap Call, the game within the game.
Welcome back to Callin' It, Alex Barth, Alex Lebowitz. Little pop quiz for you here, Alex. That song, the bed music, what was it? Why does it mean something today?
I have no idea.
That was All My Rowdy Friends by Hank Williams Jr.,
oh,
which will make its return to Monday Night Football. It was announced Monday morning by ESPN. Hank Williams is back, and now if they can just bring back Waiting All Day for Sunday Night, a little Carrie Underwood, I'll be feeling real good. But good to hear Hank Williams back. That was the soundtrack of Monday Night Football, and the open they've been using doesn't come close.
No, that was the classic. Unfortunately, he said some stuff that got him fired.
I'm not saying he wasn't justly removed, but it's good to have the song back. From musical openings of one sport to another, and I really couldn't think of a much better transition than that. Game 2 of the NBA Finals was last night. It started out with Carlos Santana in a velour sweatsuit guitaring the national anthem, and believe it or not, it went downhill from there. Look, if you're going to guitar the national anthem, there's one man who can get away with that, and he's unfortunately not with us anymore.
Yes.
And that's Jimi Hendrix. But on to the basketball game itself, which was just as, if not less interesting than the opening guitar concert. The NBA has a problem here because the Warriors are up 2-0, and I know this is what happened last year, but the Warriors are up 2-0, and it looks like there's no stopping them. And even if the Cavs do win in Game 3, how many people are going to watch it? Are you that glued to this series?
No. I mean, there's two ways you can look at this right now. You can look at it as, one, there's history being made. There's a team that could potentially go 16-0 in the playoffs. That's cool. Eh. Or you can look at it as a problem.
Right.
I'm in the latter. You know, people are saying, like, this is special. This is amazing. You see all those hot takes on Twitter. No, it's not. It's cheap. This is cheap. They took a shortcut. This is not special. This is someone who found a loophole in the rules, a loophole in the CBA, and joined forces with this team, and now we're seeing what happens. It's not special. It's a super team. It's what you should expect from a team like that, which was assembled. It's ridiculous.
Look, there's one 16-0 I care about, and we'll start talking about that July 27th, but here's how I've been saying it. Could a team of all-stars theoretically beat every other team in the NBA, if they had to, you know, go at it night in and night out, they knew they were getting everybody's best. How many Warriors players, hypothetically, if they were playing on their own teams, would have started in the All-Star game this year? Curry, Durant, Draymond, who knows what Klay's possible of if he's on another roster. And I mean, that basically leaves the fifth spot for Harden or Westbrook.
Yeah.
They have three, possibly four All-Star starters. It's not entertaining.
No.
It's not like it was built up. Look, if this is the Oklahoma City Thunder and still with Durant, it's awesome because they drafted, they developed, they had faith, they had to move the team. Cool. No, they opened up the checkbook.
It was special last year when it was that group of the drafted guys, Klay Thompson.
Oh, if Durant's not in Golden State, it totally changes the narrative.
Absolutely. But that's not the case. He joined forces. The second best player in the NBA joined a team that just set the single season record for most wins in a season.
And not just that, he joined the team that knocked him out of the playoffs the year before.
When he had a 3-1
despicable. Ray Allen-esque despicable.
Awful. And it's even worse just because Ray Allen's great, but Kevin Durant is a generational talent. He's going to have a better legacy when it's said and done than a guy like Ray Allen.
I don't know if he will now because of this.
You think this tarnishes that?
It has to, doesn't it? He couldn't. I mean, everybody talked about when LeBron left for Miami, he couldn't win on his own. And don't be wrong, LeBron is the genesis of this. This all goes back to LeBron, but there's plenty of time to bash LeBron, and we'll get into it. Durant, yes, he couldn't win on his own. He was afraid to try, and it seems like so many players in the NBA are afraid to try and win on their own.
Does he have the talent that these Hall of Fame guys he's compared to, these top 10 players of all time?
Durant?
He has the talent of them, but he doesn't have the mentality.
Right. It doesn't tarnish the fact that he's an incredible basketball player, but you talk about him as a competitor, and he's not, if I'm talking about all-time great competitors, he's not on that list. He's not even close.
No.
He wimped out.
No.
My favorite take this week, and it was on our Twitter account. You can follow us at Callin' It Podcast. Came from one Michael Felger from 98.5 The Sports Hub, that if the Cavs lose this series, LeBron should opt out and sign with Golden State. And I think that's the best way to sum it up. And what would the opinion be on LeBron if he did that? It's gotten to a point in the NBA, it's all, there are maybe two or three guys who are going out to get a ring. Everybody else is ring chasing. And that changes from year to year. Durant was out on his own last year, and then he switched to ring chaser.
Yeah.
And you know what? Russell Westbrook's not far behind. He's not going to stay with that garbage dumpster fire in OKC.
But you can't compare what anyone's done to what Kevin Durant did. You can talk about LeBron James and the decision going to Miami, forming a super team. But Miami wasn't the team that was in the way of him making it to the finals. It was the Boston Celtics.
Oh, no, absolutely. And it's a completely different narrative if LeBron joins the Celtics, but the point I'm trying to make is LeBron opened the door. Durant took a sledgehammer and turned it into one of those double-wide doors. And now they're just going to put in a revolving door. Anthony Davis can't want to stay in New Orleans that much longer. I talked about Russell Westbrook. Supposedly there's all these great players in this draft. How much longer till they pull a class of 2003 and they all just want to get together somewhere sunny with a good club scene and try to win a title? The NBA, for LeBron, started it. Durant made it okay. The NBA needs to do something to stop these players from... The GMs don't control the league. The players control the league, and it's a problem.
Do you think this is a problem solely with... So you think this is something like... Because everyone's buddy-buddy. You look at a guy like Paul Pierce and Kevin Garnett and guys from that generation, Kobe Bryant. They had legitimate rivalries with other players, individual players. They weren't buddy-buddy, and I hate to be that old
no,
guy
who's
saying
you're
that.
Right.
But no one has a problem joining forces. It seems like everyone's friends with everyone else. And last year, going back to this Golden State thing, they were recruiting Kevin Durant in the middle of the season. This is something that they had been planning for a while.
And we all thought it was ridiculous. We all said, yeah, okay, sure. Kevin Durant's going to go to Golden State,
because we didn't think he would stoop that low.
Well, it's not just that. The idea that, I mean, it was David Stern. It wasn't Adam Silver. But remember when Chris Paul was supposed to go to the Lakers?
Yeah.
The idea that the NBA would let that happen. It seemed, I mean, even in video games, teams don't get that good. It just, it's not so much that he would stoop that low, but I remember thinking, well, if he goes to Golden State, what's the point?
Yeah.
This team already nearly set the wins record. What else? And they won a ring. What else? Or they didn't win a ring. Well, they had won a ring, not that year.
Yeah.
But this team already set a wins record. They have their ring. Why? Why go to Golden State? What does that do for me, the fan? Obviously, it's great for Kevin Durant. But what does that do for everybody else on the planet?
Absolutely. It takes the fun out of it. If you were not from the Bay Area, you don't care. You're not. Maybe you do. Maybe the NBA fanboys, the NBA apologists, they love this. They look at it as witnessing history. That's not what it is. It's cheap. It's a shortcut. Now let me ask you this: we're talking about, you know, Kevin Durant and you know, just,
yeah,
this whole situation, him and Golden State. Are you, so do you think the series is done? Do you think the Cavaliers getting swept? Will they take one game in Cleveland?
I took Cavs in six. And again, because this is where we were last year, and this is the interesting part for me. It's not so much the games themselves, but this is where we were last year. Can Golden State finish it out? That's the only storyline left for me that holds any weight.
Mm-hmm.
I had Cavs in six. I'd like to believe they'll get one at home, at least one at home. I'm now thinking a little more Warriors in six. The Cavs should win one. Look, if the Celtics beat the Cavs once, the Cavs can beat the Warriors once. But just to go back to something you said, the NBA fanboys enjoy this.
Yeah.
Statistics show, I don't want to be the statistics show guy,
yeah,
but there have been studies that the NBA, more so than any other league, the average NBA fan is a fan of players, not a fan of teams.
Yeah.
You don't have really any more Celtics fans, Lakers fans, Heat fans, Cavs fans, whatever. You have LeBron fans, you have Durant fans, you have Curry fans. So to the average NBA fan, it doesn't matter what team these guys are on. They're getting what they want because they get to see more of Kevin Durant, more of LeBron James, because these guys are automatically going further down the line when they have no other competition. Now, if you're a Giannis Antetokounmpo fan, it kind of sucks, but it's just a matter of time till he's on a super team.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be. And the problem with that right there is this makes the NBA encourage this type of thing. They're now going to enable teams to do this. That was probably the reason they made the changes to the CBA that they did, so that these teams could form. But I don't know. For everyone else, it alienates fans of teams. It alienates people who are proud to be where they're from, proud to root for their local team.
Doesn't it suck as a Celtics fan? Especially with everything we've had in Boston the last decade, almost two decades now in our lifetimes, that we have to cheer for winning one game in the conference finals and getting a top pick. Doesn't it suck that we're cheering for that? I was thinking about that last night. Most Boston teams, in years when they have years like the Celtics had, if you win only one game in the conference championship, people are pretty disappointed. People are calling for heads to roll. We're out in the streets. And that sucks. There's no other way to say it. It kind of sucks being an NBA fan right now unless you're a LeBron. I'm not even going to say a Warriors fan. Unless you're a LeBron James fan or a Kevin Durant fan or a Steph Curry fan or a Klay Thompson fan or the fringe Zaza Pachulia fan or Tristan Thompson fan. If you're a Keeping Up with the Kardashians fan, then you enjoy it. But us people who follow teams, us old school fans, pre-social media fans or not. Real quick, from a league that has one kind of superstar problem to, or actually, you could say an association that has one superstar problem because it is the NBA, to an association that has another kind of superstar problem. This happened on Monday. We did the show last week on Sunday, so something I just wanted to touch on real quick. I know we're a little late on it, but Tiger Woods, the DUI last week, we're not going to have an opioid discussion. We're not going to have, is Tiger an addict problem? Obviously, the guy is in trouble. He needs help, and we hope he gets it. What I want to focus on, two questions for me from all of this. First of all, can we finally please put to bed the narrative that Tiger's going to come back and win a major? I have had people telling me as recently as really up until this happened that Tiger could still come back and he still probably would win one or two majors. That has to be dead. And the second question, where does golf have a superstar problem? Because we saw Rory almost get there and then falter. We saw Spieth almost get there and then choke. You have Sergio Garcia out here winning majors. Is golf kind of devoid of that superstar? And because Tiger Woods was there, are people expecting that Tiger Woods type figure from golf? Is it unrealistic to expect that to come back?
Yes, I think it is. I think Tiger Woods, from a marketability perspective, was everything you could hope for if you were someone who sponsors the PGA.
100%.
You know, he's a guy who came along in a sport that was stale. You know, we talked about it before the show started. He was excited. He's emotional on the course. He has that violent swing, and he can hit the crap out of the ball. He's one of the best golfers of all time. On top of that, he's not a white guy. Which
you had to think about that there for a second.
Yeah, he's not. He's half black. I think he's his mother's Thai. But that's something that, like, in a sport that's just been all white guys forever, you have this guy come along who's exciting. He rejuvenates the sport. He was a phenom in college. People were looking out for him, and he lived up to the hype.
It was almost the next step from all the Arnold Palmer documentaries we've seen in the last year. Golf was solely an upper-class, elite sport, and then Arnold Palmer comes out. I promise I'm sober. Arnold Palmer comes out. And he's just this working class guy from Western Pennsylvania, and he takes over. And it grew the game in that demographic, and then Tiger obviously taking it to another level with race. But you're right. He brought in a new viewership to golf. And I said this off the air. What golf, it seems like, is missing now, and it's not even the race thing with Tiger, which obviously was a part of it, but you mentioned Tiger's passion, the fist pumps, hugging his caddy, throwing his clubs around, yelling on the course. Happy Gilmore was on this weekend on Comedy Central. And remember why they don't kick Happy off the tour? Which, meanwhile, did you know the chick in Happy Gilmore is the mom from Modern Family?
Of course, yeah.
She aged very well. Yeah. I did not know that until this weekend. Anyway, the reason that the mom from Modern Family is able to keep Happy Gilmore on the tour is because he's entertaining. The ratings are through the roof. People want emotion out of their golfers. And the PGA, they need a Happy Gilmore type right now. Unfortunately, John Daly has moved on to the senior tour. As much as I hate that, I think not only golf, but the world needs John Daly right now. But that kind of charismatic personality is what the PGA seems to be missing.
So do you think guys like Jordan Spieth and Rory McIlroy Are they too straight-laced to
I just,
be that
well,
guy?
I mean, maybe they could have been, but they both bottomed out before they really hit that superstar level.
Like, it's not too late, though. Jordan Spieth's like he's your age, right?
He's choked so much. He's actually your old limit. He's choked so much, so often. He just seems to be – it's a Chuck Knoblauch thing where as good as he is, I think because he's choked so much, he'll never get over it. And with Rory – I don't think Rory was never necessarily – he was a very good player. Don't get me wrong. But I don't think he never was as good as people thought he was. Mm-hmm. He was the first to step into that post-Tiger Woods void, and I think some of it was, okay, well, this is how we've treated the best golfer in the world for so long because it was Tiger, and people just thought that's how you treated the world number one as opposed to a guy who really was like an all-timer. And Rory got that all-time treatment simply because that was the status quo of how you treated the best golfer in the game, and ultimately he couldn't live up to it. That's going to do it for us this week on Calling It. I'd like to thank Sean McAdam calling in earlier, talking about the Red Sox. We will be back with you next week, next Monday. More on the Red Sox as the playoffs roll along. We should have at least one champion between the NHL and the NBA at that point, I think. If not, hey, we got some good series on our hands, so all the better. For Alex Lebowitz, I'm Alex Barth. This has been Calling It, brought to you by Snap Call Sports. We will talk to you next week.
You've been listening to Calling It. This episode has been brought to you by Snap Call Sports. Snap Call, the game within the game. Available for iPhone or Android.